I'd remember overhearing my mother talking to my grade one teacher and the teacher saying that I would never learn like other children. I feel like in grade one, I was giving a sentence of struggle and really failure. This is a quote by today's guest, Barbara Arrowsmith Young. Stay tuned as we speak neuroplasticity and how Barbara is the woman who changed her brain.
Welcome to Casa de Confidence, a podcast for you. You'll hear some incredible women
and some awesome cool dudes
going confidently in the direction of their dreams and living in the purpose of their heart.
You're our host,
Julie DeLuca Collins, and you are our sidekick, hashtag handsome hot husband.
That again.
And the producer of the show.
That I am.
I am an author, speaker, coach, dreamer, and most of all,
we help people go in the direction of their dreams
and support them on their purpose. So pull up a chair,
grab a drink,
and make yourself at home because our casa
is your casa. Welcome back to another week of Casa de Confidence.
Good morning, Daniel. Actually, it's not morning anymore.
Oh, good day.
We lost an hour.
Oh, we did lose an hour.
Yeah.
Oh, that, you know what? So we went out last night with friends to a concert.
Oh my, we were out late past our bedtime.
Well, halfway through the concert, my buddy goes, you know, it's going to be an early morning for me because of daylight savings. I'm like, what are you talking about? Mm. He's like, yeah, we lose an hour tonight. I'm like, I'm totally not paying attention. You just
blew your mind.
He's just killed the show for me because now I'm tired all of a sudden.
Oh my gosh. No. You are getting old.
That's not what it was, but I was like, oh my gosh, I've never not known the day of that it was daylight savings.
Did you know that you want to hear what the bright side is of all this?
What's the bright side?
The bright side is that it's not going to get dark until, well, okay, wait. Next Sunday, the sun will set at 7:30 p.m. and won't set before 7 until October.
Explain that to the audience again.
You mean explain it to you?
I don't think they heard you.
Okay. Next Sunday, the sun will set after 7:30 p.m. and will not set before 7 until October.
In Connecticut.
Yes.
Yeah. Different regions are different.
Listen, I just think that this is good freaking news.
Mm.
Don't you think?
It's good news. I like more light. It has nothing to do with daylight savings, though.
Oh, it has to do everything with
daylight savings. Because here it just shifts it.
What?
Daylight savings just shifts it.
Sure. But I just like the fact that it's going to be light longer.
I don't think we need daylight savings anymore.
Really, Dan?
I think it's time to get rid of it. What do you think?
Don't come after me. Come after him.
They keep
listening to this.
They keep trying. I think most people are on that side of the fence.
Don't you like it when it's light out longer?
It'll always be light out longer. Well, no, actually, light out longer doesn't have to do with the way we keep it calendar. It comes with the way the position the Earth is around the sun.
Okay, hence, you know who the talent and some of the nerds are in this episode.
Daylight savings does not make your daylight any longer or shorter. So... I don't want to sound like I'm mansplaining, though. I don't want to.
No, you're not mansplaining at all. I mean, you know, but far be it from me.
So, but if they got rid of, I don't know which way they go, though. If they go earlier, daylight savings. When is daylight savings on?
Now.
So it's on now.
I don't know. Now I'm confused.
I don't know which way it goes. Anyway.
Listen, this is a lot for my brain on a Sunday. Although I am doing something very exciting later today, Daniel.
What are you doing? Did you tell me about this?
Yes, Dan. I told you about this.
Oh, yes. I know what you're doing.
What am I doing?
You're going to an Oscar red carpet party
thing. Yes, I am. And I get to dress up. So super excited about all this endeavor. Mm,
I'm so happy you get to dress up. Did you buy a new dress for the occasion?
I sure did.
Oh, very nice.
I bought, well, you know, it's not like super brand new. I mean, it is new because it came from, I don't even know what I'm saying now. Yes, it's new to me. It's new to me because it came from Amazon.
That wasn't, it's new to anybody who would have bought it.
You are correct.
It's a brand new.
you know, I don't know.
That's funny.
My brain is a little fried today because I stayed up late and I haven't done that.
You just want to say you bought the dress on Amazon. You didn't go to a Shishi store and get a Shishi dress. You got a very nice looking dress. Actually, I saw it. It's really cool.
It's a very nice looking dress for Amazon. Like is that what you're saying?
Like an ombre.
Yeah, it's an ombre. Oh, look at you knowing what ombre is.
I know what ombre is.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Hey, do you think your brain shifts and changes?
Say that again.
Do you think your brain has changed?
Yeah.
How does it change?
It changes a lot. I mean, you change, you talking about your physical brain or the way your brain works or?
The ability for your nervous system to change.
Oh, absolutely.
Based on the intrinsic and extrinsic stimuli.
I mean, it's a proven fact that you can retrain neural pathways to do different
things. Oh, look at you getting fancy with me.
You know, I was helping this author once edit a book and just proofread it for that author.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that author actually wrote about it in that book.
Oh, look at that. You remember what I wrote about.
Yeah. So you guys want to hear a little about that. You can grab Julie's book off of Amazon. It's called Confident You, right?
Simple Habits to Live the Life You Have Imagined. Were you just questioning the name of my book?
Yeah. And I'm staring at it right now, too.
Very nice.
Number one bestseller on Amazon.
Several categories.
Anyhow.
Anyway, I have a lot of reading to do, by the way.
Yeah.
I am behind in my reading, but I'm reading a very interesting book. I follow Noah Kagan in the world. And he is the founder of AppSumo. But
what?
AppSumo.
Oh.
This is where you can go get apps.
Cool.
At a very discounted price.
I just want to make sure everyone knew that because the end of that word just kind of got cut off a little bit.
Because I bit my lip.
Yeah. Oh, is that what happened?
Yeah. Anyway, so he wrote a book called The Million Dollar Weekend. And it's the surprisingly simple way to launch a seven-figure business in 48 hours. Can you believe that?
In 48 hours?
Yes, in 48 hours. I am very excited because this is essential reading. And I love the work that he has. But more importantly, for me, the one thing that I really love is that he shares how when he was in his 20s. By the way, he was employee number 30 at Facebook.
And employee number 30?
Employee number 30.
That's amazing.
And the thing about him being employee number 30 is that he got fired. He did. I mean, you know, I don't mean no disrespect to him, but the thing about getting fired from Facebook is that a lot of people, and by the way, he talks about in the book how he went and he was distraught and how he was just devastated and kind of like flounder around life. Ultimately, though, the one thing that he did is he now is a complete turnaround from where he was. He's a millionaire. He is making a lot of money with some of his new companies. But he had to change. He had to change his brain. He had to give himself that right thought that put him in the right direction to now knowing that just because he had failures, it didn't make him a failure. Those failures were the pathway for him to learn more. And again, he talks about how he didn't have a really high SAT, how he barely got into Berkeley. And again, many of the successes in his careers were not really big successes. And the thing that he did the most is he got up and continued and tried something new and continue to experiment. And this is where many of us, right, when we're hit with a challenge, when we fall off whatever it is that we're doing, when we don't hit a goal, we go into this, I'm lost, I'm done, I can't do it. And it really is something that we have to shift our brains. We have to decide.
You know what? This reminds me of a quote. We've all heard it. And I chance to say it's the most damaging saying for people in their mid to later life.
Okay.
And the more we can shed this stigma of being a little older.
Yeah.
What that saying is, we all know it. You can't teach an old dog new tricks.
That's not true. I taught Yogi some new treats.
No, that's what I'm saying. That's a damaging, that saying alone has seeped into the bedrock of our thoughts, our minds, and has given us a huge limiting belief.
Absolutely.
And that's societal.
It sure is. And I think
that's changing. Yeah. And that's changing. You see a lot more people in their mid to late doing things that your parents would have never done.
Yeah.
Your grandparents would have never done.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, again, as an entrepreneur now, I realize that life is just a series of choices. In what you decide to choose and what you decide to keep going towards. For many of us, we really have a hard time continuing to show up and level up because we have a society that tells us that at a certain age, we're done. We have a society that tells us that our brain is just the way it is, that we don't change. And this is one of the reasons why I really love today's guest. Because Barbara Arrowsmith, and I talked about how she changed her brain.
It's Barbara Arrowsmith Young, correct?
Yes, Barbara Arrowsmith Young.
I just want to be correct.
Okay, thank you. The one thing that she did is when she heard at a very young age that her teacher told her mom that she would never learn, her mom didn't take that for face value. Her mom said, no, that doesn't define you. And she has become an innovator in the field of neuroeducation. In 1978, you know, she is one of the first people that began the practical application of neuroplasticity to address learning difficulties. And the application has expanded to address the dealing with traumatic brain injury, addiction, cognitive decline, and with aging, and those who want to enhance performance. She has an incredible journey. I love her TED Talk, which will be in the show notes and people need to check it out. But I want you to know that we, like Barbara, can be the people that change our brains. We can be the people that decide different choices, and that we can really leverage the brain's ability to change and form new connections, new little highways in your brain. It's just a matter of having that curiosity, like Noah Keegan talks about, experimenting and being able to understand that, hey, by the way, it's all a practice. It is all about showing up. You know what I like to say? Consistent action takes you to the traction. I messed it up.
Stop. Yeah, you did. It's your own thing. Consistent action
gets you traction.
Very nice.
Okay. Because ultimately, you know, and see, this is what happens if we don't take care of our brain.
Well, you know what? Just get to the interview.
Okay.
I'm sure Barbara Arrowsmith Young will explain it there. Protect your brain, people.
Yes, she will. And again, she is the person you want to tune in to learn more about how you can change your brain. Hello, everybody. I am excited to have you join us again for this insightful conversation. With me today, I have an innovator and an author in the field of neuroeducation. Barbara Arrowsmith Young's work utilizes the principles of neuroplasticity and it's used worldwide to enhance cognitive functioning. Her vision is to put the brain in the education equation. Her work began in 1978, is recognized as one of the first examples of the practical application of neuroplasticity to address learning difficulties, and its application has expanded to address those dealing with traumatic brain injury, addiction, cognitive decline with aging, and those who want to enhance performance. Her journey and work is documented in her best-selling book, The Woman Who Changed Her Brain, and in her TED Talk. As the director of the Aerosmith program, Barbara continues to engage in research to understand how we can drive neuroplastic change in the brain to benefit learners of all ages. Welcome, Barbara. I said I wasn't going to read it all, but I did because it's worth reading it all.
Thank you. I'm a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, I am honored to have you here. I started my career in education. Many, many, many of my friends are in education. And I love that you are creating this connection between education and neuroplasticity, because I am sad to say that that's not something that we learn about necessarily in our schools.
I would agree. I think, in 1990, I believe it was George Bush that named it the decade of the brain. And so there was kind of an explosion of, let's try to understand the brain. I mean, it is the seat of learning. It's, you know, where we learn and understand, you know, not only academics, but also ourselves and our world and our relationship to that world. And so I think it's really, really important. And certainly there's still sort of silos, like neuroscience happens over here.
Yeah.
And education happens over here. And I've devoted my life to, you know, to really work to bridge that gap and bring them together and show educators how we can actually put neuroplastic programs right into school, because we go to school to learn. We learn with our brain. So it kind of makes sense that the brain should be part of that education. And I work with educators all around the world, and they embrace the concept. So I think it's changing. It's just, you know, change takes time.
Takes time.
I wish it didn't. Sometimes I wish I had like a magic wand that I could just wave and say, let's move, you know, this paradigm. And though I respect, even in my own life, you know, change takes time. So, but I'm really encouraged by the openness of educators. I mean, most people get into education because they want to make a difference in the lives of their students.
Yeah.
And if we give them tools that they can use to do that, they absolutely embrace and use those tools. So I say the favorite part of my work, I mean, I love the research and I love the development of the programs, but is when I actually get to go into the classrooms and meet the students that are engaged in changing their brains and hear their stories and talk to the educators and hear what the difference has been in using this neuroplastic approach versus the more traditional, you know, kind of the concept in education still is, to some extent, that the job of an educator is to impart knowledge and to impart skills, and that the learner is kind of this black box that needs to learn content, learn knowledge, and learn, you know, some skills that will allow them to learn when they're outside of school. But still, the belief that I see out there is the black box is somewhat fixed. I mean, we do understand that each black box is different. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they have different, each learner has different strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. So we can, you know, modify the curriculum to meet the profile of the learner. But what I'm arguing is actually that learner can be modified. We can actually change the brain of the learner so we don't have to modify or change curriculum. Because once that learner gets out into the world doesn't really adapt and modify and change the profile. So if we change the brain of the learner, they have that changed brain for the rest of their life. And then they can, you know, tackle whatever problems come to them, whether it's in their job, in their relationships, you know, in whatever activity they engage in. And to me, that's what's so promising about neuroplasticity is we don't have to accept that, you know, if we struggle in an area, that we have to continue to struggle throughout our life. We can change the brain. So what was once a struggle actually becomes a joy. And I know that because this work originated with my struggles and my story.
Oh, so much to unpack. I want to see, let's see the direction. I'm going to shift gears. You talked about your own personal story. Would you share a little bit of how you got started? What was your journey to get you in this path? And I'd love for you to also address for the people who are listening, who maybe the term is unfamiliar, address what neuroplasticity is. So if you can share a little bit of that, it'd be great.
Absolutely. So I'll start with neuroplasticity first, and then I'll start with my story, which was in the era where neuroplasticity, I mean, it existed, but wasn't recognized. So neuroplasticity just really means our brain is capable of change. You know, we know through research now that we can grow dendrites, which are the branches that make more synaptic connections, so better neurotransmission. We can increase glia cells that support nutrition or neurotransmission. We can enhance neurotransmitters. Like, we can change the brain at a physiological level that then changes functionality. And to me, that's so incredibly optimistic and promising that our brain is capable of change. Now, you know, my story starts way back in the 1950s when I started my schooling. And I was identified in grade one. And this was before they even had a concept of a learning disability or learning difficulty. So wow. I was identified in grade one as a slow learner because that was the terminology. And I remember overhearing my mother talking to my grade one teacher and the teacher saying that, you know, I would never learn like other children. And the teacher cautioning my mother she said, basically, don't have high expectations for your daughter because all of her schooling will be a struggle and she won't really be very successful. So I feel like in grade one, I was given a sentence of struggle and really failure. And I started to identify myself as not intelligent. I developed all those not good coping mechanisms that teachers don't really enjoy. Yeah. I mean, I would hide out in the washroom for half an hour. I figure, you know, it was probably gave my teacher a break, gave me a break. Yep. I would pretend I had a fever at home. I'd stick the thermometer on the light bulb, you know, to create a fever. And I knew it couldn't be too high because then my mother would have to take me to the hospital. So I learned, you know, what was the...
How smart were you, by the way? I just want to point that out.
Yes. So I got just the right level that meant I had to stay home. The one thing that my grade one teacher was correct about was all of my schooling was a struggle. I hope she was incorrect, you know, when she said, you know, that I wasn't going to amount to much. But that was my beginning. I struggled to learn how to read. I struggled to learn how to write. I struggled with numbers. To me, if you gave me 12 and 14, I'd add the 4 and the 1 and the 2 and the 1. It didn't mean anything to me. My mother was an educator, so she was determined that her daughter was going to learn how to read and to write and do basic math. So every day I came home at lunch because the school was right across the street. She had flashcards. After school, she had flashcards. You know, at the time I didn't really appreciate it, but now I do because I did learn how to read and I learned how to write, but it didn't address the underlying learning difficulty. Now I had those skills, which was important, but I continued to struggle really. Anything that required comprehension, understanding, logic, reasoning. So I became kind of a little memory machine. I could memorize things. And that's how I coped. Like, I would memorize my textbooks. I would look at the question on the exam and I would try to, you know, flip through my textbook in my mind and put down the correct answer. And sometimes I did a really good job and got good marks. And sometimes I failed miserably because I didn't really understand the question. It was just a matching process.
Right.
So, yeah, so my schooling was a struggle. There really was no kind of support because there wasn't an understanding at that time. And So I understand that world. I mean, I lived the struggle. Now, I was lucky because of my mother's background in education, where she taught me those fundamental skills. And my father was a scientist and an inventor. And he had this belief. He said, if there's a problem in the world and there's currently no solution, he said, it's your responsibility to go out and find a solution. And then he said, if the rest of the world tells you you can't do it, don't listen. He said, this is how science goes forward. So I had no idea what I was going to do with that. But I had this belief system. It was like, you know, so I feel like my father set me on a quest to try to find a solution to my difficulties. So that was always there in the back of my mind. And, you know, so I did manage to get through high school with a lot of stress and struggle, did go to university and studied child development, because again, I was trying to understand like what wasn't working, you know, in my life, if I could understand, you know, how cognition developed, and then went and did my master's in school psychology, again, trying to understand really what wasn't operating for me. And it was when I was doing my master's that somebody handed me a book, which was Luria, the brilliant Russian neuropsychologist, who wrote this book called The Man with a Shattered World. And he was describing the experience of a Russian soldier who had a very localized head wound during World War II. And this book was Luria explaining what was going on in this man's brain. Mm-hmm. And then this man sharing his journal, writing of his struggles. And as I read this soldier's journal, I thought, he's living my life. You know, he's obviously, I said, I knew I didn't, you know, have a piece of shrapnel in my head. But now I knew it was my brain that wasn't working the way it was designed, because I could have been writing exactly the same journal. Like, in fact, I was keeping a journal and we were using the same language to describe our difficulties. So, you know, to solve a problem, you have to understand its nature and what's the source of the problem. So now I knew it was my brain and what do I do about that? And at the same time, I was reading some work coming out of Berkeley in California, looking at this idea of neuroplasticity with rats and showing that if you put rats in an environment with lots of enrichment, lots of stimulation, lots of toys to play with, other rats to socialize with, they became better learners. Like they actually could learn mazes more quickly. So that's like a little rat intelligence test. And then they looked at their brains and they found that the brains had changed physiologically. All those things that I talked about, more neurotransmitters, more dendrites, more synaptic connections. And I thought, if rats can do that, surely humans can do that. And I remember going to all my professors at the University of Toronto and saying, wow, like I understand now what my struggles are. And I think I have a way forward. And they all said to me, first of all, learning difficulties have nothing to do with the brain. That was a belief at that time. Well, now we know they do, but that was a belief. And then they said, and even if they do, at your point, there's no human neuroplasticity. So, you know, it's kind of game over.
Wow.
And I thought, come on, if rats are capable, if their brains can change, surely we must be able to change it. So I remembered what my father said. He said, go out and try and don't listen to people that say you can't do this. And I created three different programs for myself because I had multiple learning difficulties. I didn't have one. So three very different programs for three parts of my brain based on Luria's writings and understanding the nature of that part of the brain. And I saw the changes, and they were changes that I knew there was human neuroplasticity because I worked really hard. I would study for 20 hours and sleep for 4 hours. And with all that hard work, I couldn't do the things now that I could do after the exercises. I could just read a book and understand it. I could watch 60 minutes on TV and I could understand it. Before I couldn't. I went back and taught myself all of mathematics from grade one right up to college. I could understand it. It was profound. And then at that point, I thought, well, this is great. And I've helped myself, but that's not enough. I need to bring this work into the world and help other people. And that was, many years ago. So I started developing the programs in 1978. And now I think we're in 14 or 15 different countries in multiple organizations. And that's my mission, is to make this work accessible around the world. So children don't have to struggle and learning can be joyful.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing a little bit of your journey. As you were speaking, the word tenacity kept showing up for me. I think that your dad, again, is an inventor, somewhat brilliant. And, you know, the work of your parents to support you and stand behind you. And again, they showed the tenacity of we're not taking that answer. We're going to do what we know we can. Right. What can we do to help our daughter? And I think that that's an incredible testament that when we set our minds to, you know, not take no for an answer, to kind of explore different avenues, we're always going to get some headway, if not be able to succeed in what we're looking to. I love that you talk about learning can be fun. I also admire so much that you were able to change your brain when most people said it wasn't possible. Now you're helping others do the same. What are some of the challenges that you encounter? Because certainly 1978 is a long time ago, but there's still challenges that you're encountering, I'm sure. What are some of these things that, because education reform and education is multi-layered, right? You have the administrators, you have the teachers, you have the school board, you have the state, you have the government. I mean, there's layers.
Yes.
What are the challenges? Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So I'd say that the main challenge is, again, is that paradigm shift. Like it's been a lot, education has been around for a lot of years. And I mean, really, you know, kind of after the Industrial Revolution, sort of our educational system was created. And yes, there's been shifts, but you can still see its roots back in its original creation. And it was really to educate the populace to be able to perform functions in the job world. So the idea, again, was you've got to have fundamental skills. You've got to learn how to read and to write and do, you know, numbers. And then we've recognized more recently that their skills like, you know, critical thinking, problem solving, empathy that are important, as well as the content that one learns. But I'd say the biggest is, I don't know, it's a barrier, but it's a change of mindset. Again, this concept of that, you know, that the learner is not fixed. You know, I still encounter that everywhere. Yeah. That the idea is, you know, if there's a learning difficulty, we have to work around it. We have to compensate. We have to take the strengths and use them to support the areas of difficulty. And I'm saying, no, like, leave those strengths alone. What we have to do is take those areas of difficulty and we have to strengthen them to enhance those cognitive functions through applying neuroplastic programs. And then the brain just learns efficiently and effectively. And what we see, because we've done imaging research, like looking at the brains of students with learning difficulties. And we see this pattern, which is exactly the same as what we see in the classroom. So the brain has areas that are underconnected and underfunctioning, and that's where the learning difficulties are. And they're different for each individual, depending on their learning challenge. And then what we see are areas that have hyperconnected in the brain. So they're areas that are working much, much harder to try to do the job of those underconnected or underfunctioning areas. And they can't really do those jobs because that's not what they're designed to do. So you have a brain that's working, you know, let's say 50 times harder than the brain of a student without a learning difficulty, but not as efficiently. Like, all that effort doesn't lead to the same kind of outcomes. And that's exactly what you see is that child, in my experience, walking into the classroom, I was putting in 50 times more effort than the student sitting beside me. Have my difficulties. And even with that extra effort, I wasn't doing as well as they were doing. And to me, it was fascinating when we saw that pattern in the brain, which makes sense because that is what's impacting the learning. And then what we see as students go through this exercise or this program, those underconnected areas, we see them starting to strengthen in connectivity. We have the imaging research. And then we see those hyperconnected areas being able to relax. So what you get is, you know, like, here are the hyperconnected areas, they can start to relax, these areas of difficulty start to come up. And then you have a brain that's really working functionally, efficiently, effectively. And what we also see is a creativity starts to blossom, because if you're putting in so much effort just, you know, to do the mechanics of learning and it's not efficient, you have no freed up energy to, you know, to be creative, you know, to kind of think outside of the box. And to me, that's what's exciting. We've seen, you know, beyond academics, you know, equestrian writer that becomes much more successful, people writing songs, a jazz pianist. It's really exciting because our brain is so much more than just education. Like it's what allows us, you know, as I said, to understand ourselves, to understand other people, understand our world, engage in our world. If we look at the World Health Organization, their definition of mental health is, you know, a big piece of it is being able to engage fully in our world and in our community. Well, if you have a learning difficulty, you struggle. Yeah. I know how I struggled in certain aspects. I felt out of step, disconnected, not engaged. We increase, you know, those cognitive functions. And the person walks out the door and just engages in the world. Like we have thousands and thousands of stories. Like to me, the research is important because we have to show. Yep. So we have research showing working memory improving, cognitive efficiency, cognitive flexibility, short-term memory, long-term memory, fluid reasoning, academic, like, you know, reading comprehension, ability to read, write, mathematics, all improve. We have social emotional measures. We've got measures on growth mindset improves. We have a study that showed cortisol reduced, like the stress hormone. That's important. But to me, it's the stories. Like it's, you know, to hear, I just, you know, got two emails, one from New Zealand and one from Australia this week, because it's the end of their school year. Like they end in December.
In December, yeah.
Their new school year starts the end of January. And it was, you know, two different parents talking about where their children were now. Mm. And one young girl who was just a valedictorian of her high school class. In grade one, she was told, her parents were told that she would never graduate high school.
Wow.
Now the valedictorian, the other, their siblings, a brother and a sister, one just graduated from university, has multiple job offers. The other's in her second year of law. And these students, they would be the ones that would not have completed high school. And to me, this is the power of neuroplasticity. Like we open possibilities for these individuals to take whatever path they want to take. You know, I remember an adult saying to me, she said, you know, when she went to choose her career, she said so many doors were closed. She said there was only one door open, and that was the only door I could walk through. And that was so poignant. And I think what this work does is it opens multiple doors. Now, maybe they would make the same choice to go through that one door, but now it's a choice. It's not a forced
choice. It's not a forced one. Barbara, I did, you know, love the work that you're doing, because having been in the field of education, not only, again, it's been 100 million years since I was in the classroom, but having worked with an organization that partnered with school districts, that supported teachers, that went into classrooms. And by the way, I agree with you. That was one of my favorite parts of the job, is going into the classrooms and working with students. However, there's still a lot of resistance. And this is one of the things that I wouldn't say scares me, but in essence, it does. Social emotional learning. I'm a certified facilitator of social emotional learning. I believe that this is an incredible skill. You talked about how the changes for a student not only increases their confidence and their ability to succeed, but I would imagine also creates a ripple effect.
Yes.
And it creates better relationships with our parents. Our parents are also have a little bit of that stress, because parents want the best for their children. So there's so many layers of the relationship that are being strengthened and built in a more positive way. But there's people who resist. They, you know, critical thinking skills in some school districts here in the United States is a dirty word. Social emotional learning is voodoo. Tell me more about that. How can we that are in this, in the trenches working, because I want to work with individuals who are looking to change, who can create the momentum in their lives through neuroplasticity. And again, there's people who are falling in the other side of the camp.
Yeah, I think it's that tenacity that you talked about. Like, I will talk to anybody. I will go anywhere. I think it's not getting discouraged, and I do get discouraged at times. Just keep out there giving the message and showing the data and the research. Like, yeah. It's, I made a decision in 1978 when I started this work. I could put all my energy into fighting the system mm-hmm. and trying to show there's value in this, or I could devote my time and energy to developing more programs, working with more individuals, doing the research, and eventually, if what I was doing was valid, the world would catch up. And mm-hmm. that's what happened, right? I mean, we now know there's neuroplasticity. We know learning is related to the brain. So I think it's really just keep on presenting, keep on talking, keep on demonstrating the benefits, and finding the critical partners, like the individuals mm-hmm. that are open to listening.
Yeah.
Because the people that are sort of in the old paradigm and set in their ways, they may never choose to go down a different path, and mm-hmm. that's fine. I mean, but it's those individuals that are, we look at Carol Dweck's work, the open mindset, the growth mindset. It's finding the growth mindset individuals that are open to recognizing that these things are important. Like the World Economic Forum in Geneva has published a 21st century learning skills. And in those skills, it's saying, here are things that are critical, because we don't know in 20 years from now, we don't know exactly what kinds of jobs will be out there in the workforce.
Right.
So it's not like we can educate people today for jobs 20 years from now. But what we know are these critical skills like collaboration, empathy, flexibility, critical thinking. Like, that's what the individual has to have to be successful, because they can meet any demands in the future. And that's what the brain, like, that's what this work does. Like, it's the brain that's the seed of, the ability to have empathy, to collaborate, to do perspective taking, put yourself in somebody else's mm-hmm. shoes, experience that. So I think it's just, it's having tenacity and grit and perseverance, and just keep on showing the benefits and how critical and important, this approach is. And I think with all the problems we have in the world, that if every child could reason and problem solve and think and have good mm-hmm. executive functioning, maybe we'd have different approaches to solving some of the challenges. I'm not saying that the challenges go away, but, mm-hmm. Maybe more empathy, more perspective.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm passionate.
I love that. And I can see your passion, and I'm getting excited just listening to you, because it is possible to, find allies, find the people who are doing this work and supporting them and providing them with the tools as well, which I know is a lot of the work that you're doing. Many of my teacher friends lately have been struggling because the mental health of their students since we went through the global pandemic has been affected. How can they help to equip their students and transform their mental health with neuroplasticity?
Well, it's a really, really good question. I think, some of the things like pre-neuroplasticity, like all of what you talked, good social emotional curriculum, helping them also just recognize the whole world went through an incredibly challenging time, and there are changes that we still don't quite know what they all mean in the world. So I think first thing is, don't deny that we went through an incredible stress. Mm-hmm. Right. And it was an incredible disruptor. And as humans, I think we started this conversation, we don't really like change. We like to hold on to things the way they were, because it gives us security and the feeling of safety. And that's not what happened. Like, everything got tossed up in the air, and some of the things haven't still quite landed. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, my advice is, like, deeply listen to your students, validate their experience, and have open dialogue and conversations with them to help them understand like that this was a stress, this was something that was real that happened, and how are we going to work together to move through this? Like, I think, you know, we're a community, like that is really, we're a social community, like, you know what they say, a lone ape is a dead ape, right? Like,
we
function within communities. So it's like bringing that community of the classroom together, because probably a lot of the students have had the same kind of experience, and having really open conversations and dialogues and then doing some problem solving, like together, how can we move through this? And also, I think recognizing that it's going to take time. Like, you know, we live in a society where everything has to be instant, and, you know, there's a problem, we should have a solution tomorrow. Well, not really. I mean, it's not really how the world works. Is sort of honor that things take time. And yeah, so some students fell back, you know, a bit academically because of the pandemic. But, you know, the good thing about our brain is with neuroplasticity, it will catch up, right? And so I think it's to assure students and give them a sense of, you know, safety and security again.
Oh, I thank you for that answer. And I think that it is very important to, again, leverage community, leverage, you know, the sense that we're in this together, and to explore all the different possibilities. Kind of taking a step back, because there's some, obviously, I've been doing a lot of reading in neuroplasticity. This is something that intrigues me. Brain science, I'm kind of geeking out. I really wish this was something that I was introduced to in high school. And again, given other doors that I could go into. One of the things that I learned, and I'd love for you to maybe explain, because you touched upon what is neuroplasticity, and I would like to address a little bit of how it works, because I've heard of functional or structural neuroplasticity and also functional change, right? So explain that to me. Okay. What are the two differences?
Yeah, so the structure is the brain structure. Like that's the things like the, you know, those branches on the synapses, the dendrites, you know, in some cases creating new neurons, increasing the transmitters. So it's the structure of the brain that changes, right? So that's the structural change. And those structural changes lead to functional changes. So like the structure is changing, and as a result of that, function changes. And the function is, you know, your ability to remember, like it becomes more efficient, more effective, or your ability to reason, like depending on where those structural changes are happening. Like one of the things, you know, the research out of Berkeley did that was a light bulb moment for me is they blindfolded a group of rats and they put them in a very tactile environment. Like, so they had to navigate through sense of touch. And the part of the brain that changed was the somatosensory cortex, which was specifically related to sense of touch, navigation through space, through sensory feedback. And I thought, and then the researcher said differential stimulation leads to differential effect. So the functional change happened in a specific part of the brain because of the activity and the stimulation that was given that led to specific functional changes. So that said to me, okay, if I can create an exercise or an activity that targets a specific part of the brain, I'll change that part of the brain structurally. And then this kind of function will change because that's the job of that part of the brain. So if we think about the function as sort of the job and the structure as sort of the underpinnings, you know, that's what neuroplasticity is all about. And the one thing that's important to think about neuroplasticity as well is it's really a neutral concept. It just means our brain can change.
Right.
So our brain can change in positive ways, but it can also change in negative ways.
Absolutely.
And the things that we can all do in our life that support good brain health are, we hear over and over, get good sleep, get some aerobic exercise, and that could just be walking 20, 25 minutes a day. Doesn't have to be going to the gym, you know. So if it's good for your heart, it's good for your brain. That's kind of the rule of thumb, the exercise. Reduce stress. Like, so we know, like meditation, some people don't like to meditate. It might be that walk again, go out and walk in nature, which is very relaxing, you know. So we know reducing stress, getting good sleep, good nutrition, exercise, all of those kinds of things that we have control over mostly in our life are neuroprotective, right? They, you know, are positive for the brain, like, you know, to keep our brain healthy. So anybody can do that. And then I say, you know, if you want to take an activity, you know, to make it kind of a boost neuroplastic change, is, you know, you pick an activity, something that you want to do because you need to engage with it. So whether maybe you always want to learn how to dance, or maybe you always want to learn how to play chess or learn a language. So you pick something that you want to do, so you engage in it. And then you need to probably do, you know, 20 to 30 minutes a day of whatever the activity is that you pick. And you need to calibrate the level of difficulty. That's really important. Mm-hmm. If you make it too simple, your brain's just going to be on autopilot, right? It's not going to be getting stimulated. And if you make it too difficult, you can't engage. You're going to avoid. So you find, just like a physical exercise, you find that sweet point, you know, like, so maybe it's the 10-pound weight that you're going to start with at the gym, not the 5-pound. And then you build up 15-pound. So the same thing for your brain, is, you know, find where there's a little bit of strain, but not too much. And then once there's no more strain anymore, your brain has changed to reach that level. And then you increase the level of difficulty. So it's kind of that step-by-step progression. And in neuroscience, they call that effortful processing. It's a big term just to mean that you're making your brain process. With some effort. And over time, if you do that, that will drive neuroplastic change in your brain. So I just say it's really simple. You need to, you know, enjoy. So you find something you enjoy. You need to engage. And you need to do that effort for processing, right? And you can be doing a workup for your brain in your own daily life.
I was thinking about, as you're speaking about doing this, not doing the too simple, not doing the too hard, I've been thinking about a skill that I've been trying to adopt since 2018. And I've been working, I can't even say that I've been working. I wanted to learn to knit. And boy, oh boy, do I not get it at all. And now I know the basic stitch, and I know that I need to continue to practice to get better. But it is so overwhelming to move to the next level, and I don't practice it, right? So I give it up. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to just do the basic stitch because it's too easy, whatever. This is boring. And then the harder it gets, it's like, oh, I'll never get it. And I give up. So then when I don't practice the skill, I'm not getting any better. Yes. And it's in the practice that we get better. It's in the doing the work. And I love that you talk about, you know, we don't want to automate it, right? With the simple. And by the way, I'm a tiny habits coach. So I know starting with tiny is great to create a habit, but you're not looking for the automation when you're trying to change your brain. You're looking for actually kind of giving your brain a workout, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's you know, as I said, finding that spot that is just a bit of a strain, but not too much of a strain, and then practicing, and then when it only becomes a strain, making it a bit of a strain. Like it is, but you know, and once you do it, you feel it and know it. And maybe too, it in some ways, it's whether, like, there's some things I know in my life, like there shoulds, like, oh, I should do that.
Right, I should,
I really want to knit? Like, that would be my question.
Yeah, you know, that's another question I guess I should explore. Should I, or do I want to? It sounds promising. You know, the reason I started to learn to knit is I had major surgery, and I thought, oh, well, I'm going to be down and not going to be able to do much of anything. So I might as well be productive, because sometimes sitting around for me is like, I'm not being productive. I should be doing something else, when it's not necessarily true. Mental health is one of the incredible things that are the benefits, and why neuroplasticity is important. Mm-hmm. Also, as we get older, our cognitive capabilities need to be enhanced. And I would imagine that, again, this is one of the reasons why we want to practice neuroplasticity. And obviously, you know, there's so many different things that we don't know about the brain. You talked about tangible things that we can do. Eat well, exercise, get some sleep, stimulate, do activities that are stimulating. What else can we do for ourselves and then teach these practices to students?
Yeah. Well, the other thing, which I forgot and you just triggered it, is social relationships are so important. All the research looks at, you know, that having good social connections and social relationships across our life is, again, neuroprotective and really, really good. So starting those things early in school, like, again, going back to that principle, school is not just reading, writing, and arithmetic. It's starting to, you know, help students understand how do we keep our brain healthy, because we can't escape it. It's with us 24/7 and it's with us throughout our lives. And to me, it's really, if not our most important asset, one of our most important assets, because it allows us to navigate the world. And so I think it's really, you know, we need to educate students on how do we keep our brain healthy, like all of those kinds of things, you know, habits that you talk about, and then put cognitive exercises as part of the regular curriculum. Like there's a school in Madrid in Spain that 30 minutes a day, and also in New Zealand, and I think there's one in the United States and one in Canada, 30 minutes a day, all the students in each grade are doing one of my cognitive exercises. And we've done research to show the benefits, comparing the students not like in another classroom, not doing the exercise versus the students doing the exercise. We see processing speed increase, vigilant attention increase. So it's really critical to help students understand this magnificent organ that we have, what it does, how to keep it healthy. And then just as a natural part of going to school, we are stimulating our brain. And, you know, each grade, these students do a different cognitive exercise. So in grade one, they work on the part of the brain that's involved in motor planning, which is critical for learning how to write, which is part of what you do in grade one. Grade two, we work on visual symbol pattern memory, the part of the brain that learns patterns to read no matter what language you read in. Grade three, we do the part of the brain that's related to numeracy and understanding number. Grade four, we go into reasoning. Grade five, thinking, executive functioning. So to me, it's, you know, we should demystify the brain. Like it's just to support students. And then how do we keep our brain active across our lifespan? You know, I don't know what our life expectancy is now, but it keeps going up. Like we're going to live a lot of years. And so let's keep this organ as healthy as possible so we can have a satisfying, engaged, enriched life experience.
Well, it's so much to unpack when it comes to the brain. You have definitely given us an incredible amount of information that I'm so grateful for, because again, I think that this is a conversation that we need to be having. We need to be incorporating teaching neuroplasticity and the ability for students to change. I've seen the struggle that a lot of students have when it comes to learning challenges, and we need to start creating the environment where we are empowering them as opposed to disempowering them. And the work that you're doing is incredibly important. We didn't unpack everything that I wanted to, but you're going to have to just come back, because this is an incredible conversation. I would love for the listeners to definitely send us questions or thoughts on this episode, because this is for some people, may be a new conversation. And there might be some questions about how they can bring the program, the Aerosmith program, into their schools. And maybe if they're educators, how to be able to incorporate it, or they themselves work in conjunction with the work that you're doing. So tell us, how can people connect with you, Barbara?
Yeah. So the best way is our website, which we've just totally redesigned. And it's Aerosmith, my middle name. So AerrowSmith.ca. And there's a wealth of knowledge on that website. Like we've got webinars on, you know, how our brain shapes us, like all sorts of webinars that are really insightful. My TED Talk is there. We've got some books that are free downloads that authors have generously contributed. And then the email connections are there. And we're happy to speak to educators anywhere in the world to help them advocate to bring this kind of work into their classroom. So we welcome people to reach out and connect with us.
Well, I appreciate that, you know, you've made the information so accessible to so many people. I think that, again, in an era in which, you know, we're understanding and just scratching the surface, there are so many individuals, students, and now adults, right, that have been labeled dyslexic or reading difficulties, you know, math difficulties, nonverbal difficulties, ADHD. All of these things can really be things that we empower our students through and adults right. through by, you know, by bringing in neuroplasticity, understanding it, and working to change our brain. So thank you, Barbara. I love this work. Continue to do what you do. And make sure that you also check out Barbara's TED Talk. You read the book and you let her know that you found her through the Casa de Confidence podcast, everyone. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Julie. I really appreciate it.
No, you're amazing. And don't forget, go confidently in the direction of your dreams.
Thanks for listening to Casa de Confidence. We thank you for listening. And if you want more, go to casadeconfidencepod.com. Check Julie out on her socials as Julie DeLuca Collins. And you can also check out her website at goconfidentlycoaching.com. Have a great week, and don't forget, go confidently in the direction of your dreams.